Okay, folks, well, thanks for coming along tonight for discussion of My Last Drink, which is the book recently published, edited by Ross Fitzgerald and Neil Price. My Last Drink, 32 Stories of Recovering Alcoholics. And there are copies of the book for sale tonight, and others will be up on sale on our website after tonight's event. Now, we're going to start off with three speakers who speak for about 10 minutes each, and I'll introduce them. So first off, we'll lead off with Ross Fitzgerald. He's spoken here on a number of occasions, and Professor Fitzgerald is a historian and an author, and in this case, the co-editor of My Last Drink. Then Di Young, who's been around the Institute for quite a while as the former owner of Federation Press, which was a successful publisher. We've had her authors here, but tonight she's here as a contributor to the book and currently is in practice as a psychotherapist. And Tim Olson is running a little bit late, but he's a gallery owner and an author of a recent book and also a late arriver. So we're going to lead off with Professor Fitzgerald, to Di Young, and to Tim Olson, if he makes it, and then we'll go to questions and discussion. Ross.
Thanks, bro.
Right. Well, thank you, Gerard. It's very good to be here. As my Uncle George used to say, at my age, it's very good to be anywhere. On his deathbed, I said to Uncle George, "You know, you were my favourite relative." To which he responded, "There wasn't much competition." I thought that was funny, anyway. And thanks, Gerard, for your sage advice concerning this book, My Last Drink, 32 Stories of Recovering Alcoholics. It was you, Gerard, who convinced my Tasmanian-based co-editor Neil Price and me to title our anthology My Last Drink instead of Last Drinks as we were planning. It's obvious to us now that My Last Drink has a much more personalised and intimate tone and timbre. But friends, much to my chagrin, I recently discovered that there is another remarkable book titled My Last Drink, written by Joseph H. Francis and first published in 1915. It is modestly subtitled The Greatest Human Story Ever Written. This My Last Drink is the autobiography of a Chicago older person who plummeted from power and wealth to poverty and prison. He then became a leading light of the American temperance movement. Believe it or not, Alderman Francis's memoir is still in print. And that presents a problem. How do we humble Australian authors and editors compete with the greatest human story ever written? Well, Neil Price and I have certainly tried our best. Many in this audience may recall when, decades ago, hotels in Australia closed at 6 p.m. and the public bar was only open to men, creating the notorious 6 o'clock swill. The pub manager or owner would always call, "Time, gentlemen, please. Last drinks. Hurry along now." The notion of last drinks has entered deeply into the Australian lexicon. But there is another kind of last drink, the last one that an alcoholic takes before she or he gets sober. My Last Drink, 32 Stories of Recovering Alcoholics, released this month by Connor Court and also available from Amazon and Booktopia, is a collection of inspiring and hitherto unpublished stories, original for this book, that canvass and explain how 32 recovering alcoholics managed to stop drinking and to stay stopped. It was Neil Price who conceived the idea for an anthology of sober alcoholics recounting how they achieved and maintained sobriety. Contributors to My Last Drink are alcoholics of all ages, of different sexualities and genders, and of Indigenous and non-Indigenous backgrounds. This collection of revealing stories includes long and short-term sober alcoholics from many professions throughout Australia. All contributors, 14 women and 18 men, tell a deeply personal tale of the last 24 hours of their alcoholic drinking. In our book, the word sober means free of alcohol and other drugs. In my case, these days, as a long-time sober member of Alcoholics Anonymous, I have nothing in my blood but blood. Since its inception in 1935, and the first AA meetings occurred in Australia in 1945, but since its inception in America in 1935, members used only their first names to identify themselves. As Neil Price points out, this was a protective strategy. Given the social stigma of being an alcoholic or addict at the time, anonymity was seen as a necessary way to protect a person's privacy. The use of nicknames developed to identify long-term members based on character traits and has helped to form a unique fellowship in Australia. In Australia, the names Antique Harry, Circus Lil, Adequate from Arncliffe, who was my darling late wife, Lyndall Moore, who was sober for 45 when she died, but she would always talk about in her work, striving for adequacy, not for perfection. And that and James Thurber's motto, don't get it right, get it written, got me started writing. Other nicknames are Bowtie Frank, Breathless Beryl, Broken Hill Jack, and his brother Raucous Dick, who had no sense of volume. And they were and are well-known members of the AA Fellowship. In my last drink, some contributors are identified by their full names, including Norma Christian, Dick Love, Di Young, and Tim Olson when he appears. A number of authors are identified by their first name, plus the initial of their surname. For example, our friend Kaz K and Shane F and Val C from the North Sydney AA group, who are with us here tonight. Others simply adopt their first name or nickname. For example, Kim, my friend Davo, and Ukrainian George. Contributors to this unique collection include builders, novelists, journalists, artists, lawyers, musicians, therapists, nurses, bus drivers, accountants, police officers, web designers, and army personnel. As Neil and I write in the introduction to My Last Drink, which I have used in this talk, quote, it is important to understand that there are no rules in Alcoholics Anonymous. In fact, the only requirement for membership is a desire to stop drinking, no matter how slim is that desire. Even AA's 12 steps and AA's 12 traditions are in no way mandatory. They are only suggestions. This includes the tradition of anonymity. In Alcoholics Anonymous, alcoholism is treated as a health problem, not a moral problem. Hence, alcoholics are not regarded as bad people who need to get good, but sick people who can recover if we don't pick up that first drink of alcohol one day at a time. Alcoholism, we argue, is a disease of denial and resistance. A psychiatrist once asked me to visit an alcoholic patient at the Wesley Hospital in Brisbane. When drunk, he tried to kill himself with a shotgun. He had blown one arm off and part of his abdomen. In the hope that he might identify, I told him part of my drinking story. Within minutes, the patient put up his remaining hand and said, if ever I get as bad as you, Ross, I'll give it up. When I was in North Queensland, filming a TV documentary for the ABC about ex-Queensland Labor Premier and Federal Treasurer Red Ted Theodore, arguably the most talented politician ever, or Labor politician, never to become Prime Minister, the film crew and I arrived at a local pub in a small country town. The licensee's wife told me that she had locked the publican in the toilet to prevent him from drinking. In his delirium, he had attempted to eat the AstroTurf in the toilet. But when I suggested that he go to an AA meeting, his wife said, "Oh, he's not that bad." It's true, both of them. In Alcoholics Anonymous, there is room for everyone, no matter how far down the scale of life they have gone. Members include firm and tepid believers in a higher power, as well as agnostics and atheists, of whom in the fellowship there are many, including myself and Neil Price. As we explain in the introduction, the AA program is in the broadest sense a spiritual program, but not a religious one. In our experience, over the long term, most alcoholics cannot stop drinking and stay stopped through an exercise of the individual will. That is why a number of sober alcoholics regard the meetings of Alcoholics Anonymous, which we attend, as something greater than their isolated self. As the Swiss psychoanalyst Carl Jung wrote to the co-founder of Alcoholics Anonymous, Bill Wilson, "The most helpful motto for an alcoholic is spiritus contra spiritum. That is to say, spirit against spirit, power against power." Jung thought that to get and stay sober, an alcoholic needs to find something more powerful than alcohol. For many of us, that power is to be found in AA itself. There are no dues or fees for membership in Alcoholics Anonymous. Moreover, no one can be expelled from AA, which has no bosses. Indeed, in our opinion, Alcoholics Anonymous is a prime example of peaceful anarchism in action. The contributing editors of My Last Drink are both sober alcoholics. I have been sober for 52 years, Neil Price for 39. We both still regularly attend meetings of Alcoholics Anonymous. The truth is that AA helps tens of thousands of alcoholics recover from a seemingly hopeless condition. This is demonstrated by Professor George E. Valiant's path-breaking book, The Natural History of Alcoholism Revisited, published by Harvard University Press. Come in, Tim, there's a, up the front. Here we are, Timmy.
Thank you.
So I was just saying, Tim, that the efficacy of AA is demonstrated by Professor George E. Valiant's path-breaking book, The Natural History of Alcoholism Revisited, published by Harvard University Press. A leading American psychiatrist, Professor Valiant's large-scale longitudinal study demonstrates that even though it is very difficult for alcoholics to stop drinking and stay stopped, AA is by far the most effective agency in helping alcoholics to recover. So as Neil Price and I often say to newcomers and to their families, why not avail yourself of the best? As thousands of alcoholics are either sober, as thousands of Australians are either sober alcoholics themselves, or are relatives and friends of alcoholics who are sober or trying to get sober, Neil and I hope that avid readers, and especially those interested in alcoholism and addiction, will find My Last Drink to be intellectually helpful and practically useful. At the very least, we hope that this illuminating anthology might encourage people whose drinking is getting out of control to attend some meetings of Alcoholics Anonymous, most of which are open to everyone and available throughout Australia. Our advice to a prospective newcomer is twofold. Ask yourself a simple question. Is alcohol costing you more than money? And if the answer is yes, go to one or two AA meetings and try to listen for the similarities, not the differences. There is unambiguous proof that AA works. For anyone with a problem with the booze, joining this remarkable fellowship could be a life-changing decision. As Neil Price and I have been sober buddies for almost 40 years, it has been an enjoyable and exhilarating experience working together on this fascinating project. As it happens, my last drink was at the same place as where, when I was barely 14, I had my first one. In fact, I've only been properly sober since I've been free of alcohol and all other drugs as well. That occurred here in Sydney on Australia Day, 26th of January 1970. But that's another story, which along with 31 other revealing tales is in the book, My Last Drink, 32 Stories of Recovering Alcoholics. Finally, friends, here's a trick. As AA can teach us, if you don't pick up the first drink, you can't get drunk. How about that? If you don't pick up the first drink, you can't get drunk. Thank you.
Thanks, Ross. So we go to Di Young and Tim. Tim Olsen's here. So Di and then Tim. 10 minutes in. Di, off you go.
Just move back.
Well, thanks for the opportunity of being here. It's a privilege. Thank you, Gerard and Anne and Ross and Neil for putting together the anthology. When Ross asked me to say a few words, he said, just tell him a bit of your story. I thought, well, I don't think I can do that, really. It's a bit extreme. But, you know, he's been insistent, so I'm going to tell you a little bit about myself. It's in the book. That's sort of the edited version. And I suppose what I want to say to you is that I'm probably slightly unusual in that now I'm sober a long time, but I got sober at a very young age. Now, I came from a family that were alcoholic. My mother was an alcoholic, my father was a chronic gambler, and I had no limits in my life, so I was, playing up at quite an early age. I didn't particularly think there was anything wrong with that. I loved alcohol because of what it gave me. And for those of you that drink with control and you're not alcoholic, it gave me those same things. I would drink, I would feel better about myself, I thought I looked better, I was sexier, you know, I looked like I could hold a conversation a lot easier, I was more intelligent. And, of course, I was prepared to pay the price for quite a while of what, because I got out of it so much. Now, I'm a product of the era in which I grew up, and I use drugs the same way that I use alcohol, and I know that's not what we're talking about tonight, but it is a big part of my story. Hence, I stumbled into Alcoholics Anonymous at a very young age. I was 17 and a half years old, which now I look at 17 and a half year olds and I think, my God, they're young. I didn't feel young at 17 and a half. I felt old, I felt worn out, and I was met a man who was at pub. Course, where else was I going to meet one? And he took me to my first AA meeting. Now I'm just going to clean it up a little bit. When he told me his story, I was very unwell one night, and he decided to tell me his story. And one of the things that happens in Alcoholics Anonymous is there's a lot of sharing of your story, what happened to you, what happened to you. And that's how we get the identification. It's one of the curiosities that, I now, for my sins, work at South Pacific Private Hospital, which is a private psych hospital on the Northern Beaches, and they treat people with alcoholism, drugs, PTSD and mood disorders. And they will often, you know, when they're talking to psychiatrists, the clients will be very happy to talk about all sorts of things. But it's not until they sit with someone who's just like them that they get the identification they need. And the same thing happens in AA. People will walk into a room not dissimilar to this, with a cross-section of the community not dissimilar to you, and somebody will say, how are you going? And they'll talk a little bit about themselves. And without judgment, without criticism, there will be some sort of, yes, I know, that's what happened to me, or yes, I've been there. Now, I don't know about your lives, but if you think about how many places you can go in your life today and actually tell the truth about yourself to someone you've never met before and not be judged. It's a big statement. And that's the kind of identification that people get in Alcoholics Anonymous. Now, I went into AA, I mucked around with it for a while. I was very young. I decided that I would, go out and try again, have a little bit of, do a bit more experimenting. And I came back into the rooms of Alcoholics Anonymous for two reasons. One, I had nowhere else to go. And the second one was that I'd been around the rooms for 8 months and I had seen it work in the lives of people like Ross and Neil and other people that are here tonight. And I can, you can tell me all you like. You can tell me what I should do. You can demand that I behave a certain way. But if you show me what you do and how you recover, that has a much bigger impact on me. And that's exactly what happened. So I came back into the rooms of Alcoholics Anonymous. Now, it's well known. For years and years, I guarded my anonymity. In my Federation Press publishing days, I guarded my anonymity very carefully. I don't much mind about it now. My daughter's old. She's an older 32-year-old woman with children herself. I don't feel like I have to tell any, worry about any of that stuff anymore. So I came into the rooms and the people that cared about me just before I got sober were the police. There was nobody else that was much interested else apart from them. They seemed to be very interested in my well-being. And they finally did catch me. I was moving a bit slow one day and they caught up with me. And I eventually, came back into Alcoholics Anonymous and started to get well. Now, I was homeless, jobless and friendless. So I had a lot to do to put my life together. And I also needed to find a job to pay for the barrister's fees to try and stay out of jail. It wasn't a prospect I was particularly keen about. And I said to Ross, what do you want me to tell you? He said, tell them the Mr. Perkins story. So I'm going to tell you the Mr. Perkins story. So I went for a job as a shorthand typist. Now, there will be people in the room just looking at the audience that will remember what shorthand looked like. And you can remember the typewriters that used to do this with and then that, right? Do you remember those? I'm getting a few nods. Good. I'm not feeling like I'm out on my own here. So, and if you made a mistake, you had to rub out on three different things. There's some people who are looking at me thinking, I have no idea what you're talking about. But anyway, let's continue on. And so I had forgotten how to do shorthand. I'd forgotten how to, tie. It was a bit of a disaster. And Mr. Perkins, God love him, said to me, I'd been there for a couple of weeks and I'd go into his office and he'd dictate shorthand and I'd have my pad under my desk here trying to write very fast what he was saying because I'd forgotten how to do shorthand. One night he stayed back. I thought he's going to sack me. I told a few fibs to get the job. And he said to me, he's standing over me and I was sitting down at my desk and he said, "What? Well, how are we going, Diane?" I said, "We're not doing very well, are we?" And he said, "No. What seems to be the problem?" I said, "Look, I've been unwell and, I've been drinking too much, taking too many drugs and I'm, trying to put my life together." And I said a few other things. And he said, "How are you doing that?" And I said, "Well, I'm going to AA." And he went, "Really? You're going to Alcoholics Anonymous?" I went, "Yes." And he went, "How often do you go?" And I said, "I go every day," which was true. And he said, "Well, will you go to night school and learn to do the things I'm paying you to do?" And I said, yes, I'll do that. I'll go to night school. And he said, wait a minute. You said you go to meetings every night. What happens if you don't go to meetings? And I said, well, I suppose I'll drink. Now, I didn't mean that I would, drink if I went to night school, but that's how he took it. He said, forget about the night school. And then he taught me all of it. He'd dictate very slowly, "Dear Mr. Smith, have you got that, Don?" So we became this sort of, now this was the first person outside of the rooms of Alcoholics Anonymous who had any faith in me. My family had passed, gone, given me away because I'd been behaving so badly. Now, we continued on. And, many of us have an enormous fear of failure. We've merely made a mess of our lives. Well, I have anyway. I should speak about myself. So there was a part of me that wanted to really do well. So I worked very hard for this man and I was very grateful for all the opportunities he gave me, and he gave me many. He was a practicing Catholic with 9 children, interestingly enough, Ross, but there you go. And after a couple of years of working for him, my trial came around per se take that long to do. And I went into the room and I said to his office and I said, look, I need to talk to you with the door shut, which meant this was serious. And he said, what? Okay, what's happened? I said, I need to resign. He said, why do you need to resign? I said, I'm going to jail. And he went, what? Hang on, whoa, what? What? I said, well, I didn't, there was part of the story I didn't tell you back there because I thought we were at least, we were managing the night school stuff. I didn't want to worry about anything else, right? He said, wait a minute, what's happening? So I explained what was happening, that I was going to go to jail while the trial was on, that I didn't know, it didn't look very good. It looked like we were going to get, you know, found guilty. We could have were. And anyway, he said, leave it with me. Came back to me a few hours later and he said, I don't want you to resign. I want you to take annual leave. I said to him, I don't think you understand. And he said, no, 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 just do what I'm asking you to do. And I went, okay. So I took annual leave. Now, I worked in a room, a large office, since it was an insurance office, with 30 women. Now, do you remember the time, this is the time in Australia when number 96 was the sort of thing on television, right? So that was always the talk of the net at morning tea, everybody talking about number 96. Abigail featured quite largely in that. Do you remember Abigail?
Yeah.
She was a rather buxom sort of actor on the thing, right? And I never saw it because I was always at a meeting, so I'd have to sort of try and make up and pretend that I knew what was going on. I had no idea what was going on. So the trial, of course, came on. And, sorry, the trial came on. It's my timer telling me something.
Yeah.
What's it telling me? That I should stop?
No.
No, no, no.
Anyway, so the trial, of course, came on. I went to Stillwater Women's Prison for 2 weeks while the trial was on. It was just awful. I can't begin to tell you how horrible it is. If you think anybody's having fun in those places, think again. And there were a number of women from the streets that were there. So it was like I'd been missing. I'd been 2 years sober. Right, and I walked into this remand section of the Silverwater Women's Prison and they went, Di, how are you? Where have you been? It was like I'd gone next door to, you know, for a day or two and come out. You know, it was like, hang on, I've been gone for two. Do you look at me, I look well, don't I? You know, didn't get any of that. Now, we were found guilty, of course, and the judge, God bless him, said, all right, we're going to put you back in jail for the weekend while I consider what the sentence is going to be. God love them. And I subsequently worked with many of them in the legal publishing world and they would have been horrified to know who they were working with, but never mind. And then they called us through. You know the beautiful building that the courthouse in Darlinghurst? It's just gorgeous. Underneath that beautiful building is a labyrinth warren of small walkways and cells. So when you're in that court, what they do is they back the truck up and you get out, they open the door and you go straight under the underground.
Sorry.
It's most bizarre. You go underground. So you know, it's just amazing. So I'm in the paddy wagon on my own. They pick you up at 5 a.m. in the morning and you go underground when they finally get you there from Silverwater. And there's two very burly big prison officers with me. And I, without thinking, said out aloud, what's that smell? And one of them, towering over me, said to me, it's fear, love. I thought, I'll never forget this day as long as I live. And I, of course, went through and there was men everywhere. And a very junior constable saw me and put me in a tiny little cell on my own and he said, you'll be safe in here. And I never forget that kindness of that man because they could have put me in any of the other ones.
Hmm.
Now you come up through the bowels of that into the dock and this particular day on the Monday morning when they're going to cast the sentence, they're calling for character witnesses. I thought, this is a disaster. Nobody has told me that I'm supposed to have a character witness speak for me. The three men I was involved with in this court case had character witnesses, you know, all these people, you know, councillors and, you know, mayors and all sorts of, I thought, this is a disaster. Anyway, they finally got to me, and the judge said to the barrister, is there anybody to speak for Diane Young? And the barrister picked up and he said, yes, Mr. Thompson. Mm. Now, Mr. Thompson was Mr. Perkins' boss. And he had come in with Mr. Perkins sitting next to him to speak on my behalf. I'd worked for them for 2 years. I hadn't had a sick day. I'd done everything they'd asked me to do and more, but I didn't expect this. And Mr. Thompson got up, as you know, with a lot of credibility and spoke about, because he was a manager of this very large insurance company, and said, you know, blah, 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 all sorts of things about me. And the judge told the barrister to stop talking. He said, stop talking, stop talking, stop talking. And he said to Mr. Thompson, who was in the door, if I let her go, will she still have a job? And he said, absolutely, she will. And he went, interesting. Now, I'd had a lot of narcotic addiction, and I had a deputy matron, as they were called in those days, at Manly Hospital, get up and speak to my, for me. I didn't know she was going to be there either, and he stopped the barrister again and said to her, Leslie, when she was detoxing, did she do it cold turkey or with methadone? Now, this was very unusual for this to happen. People didn't know about this stuff back then. I'm talking many, many years ago. And she said she did a cold turkey. Now, I got out of that with a five-year bond, and I reported every week for 5 years. And the rule, the caveat was, if you miss one, there's a warrant put out for your arrest. And you go straight in and you do the whole lot. I didn't miss one, ever. Now, the only reason I tell you that story is that somewhere in the midst of all of our lives, when we've been on our knees, we will often, we talk about the kindness of strangers in Alcoholics Anonymous. Do you remember I talked about earlier, if you walked into a room of strangers and you were on your knees about anything and you told them something about yourself that you didn't want to talk about with everybody, where you would actually feel not judged and welcomed. And it was the same with those two men. I owed them much. They owed me nothing. But they actually were, am I right? And they were the ones that stood up for me. And that was the big, now there's been many other things since that time. And I'm very grateful that I was given those opportunities to have those people in my life. I'm going to finish up now and pass it back over to Jerry. Thank you.
So this function is lacking the discipline of a normal AA meeting. People have gone a bit over time. At any rate, here we go. Both of you have. So, Tim Olson. You got about 10 minutes, Tim. Or
all right.
Push it a bit.
Mm-hmm.
It's okay. Good.
Hi, good evening everyone. I apologise for being slightly late, but of course my alcoholic mind thought that people were going to have drinks and then there was going to be speeches. I didn't realise, of course, judging by the book I've shown, I should have known better. But my name is Tim Olson and I'm a non-practising alcoholic, and I've been sober now for 11 years. And I use that term non-practicing because there's always going to be an alcoholic in me that is going to think that maybe there's a chance that I could pick up a drink again. But there's a part of me that knows damn well that if I did, that I'd go back to the life that I had before. And what really draws me back to that memory is really, it's quite, I mean, when I think of the title of the book, My Last Drink, I really prefer to not think that way, because if I remember my last drink, I think, geez, that was a good one. But when I think of my last drunk, that's when I really know that I can't drink, because my last drunk wasn't good. And it's quite ironic that today's Halloween, And one of the reasons I'm late was also because every crossing in Willara and Paddington had children crossing it. And it really was nearly a horrific case of murdered children with me trying to get here on time. But really and truly, it is ironic because at the end of my drinking, I remember being so sick and so unwell that when I looked in the mirror, I really was my own worst horror. I couldn't believe who I'd become. I looked at myself and I was a very, you know, sprightly, good-looking young man who had the world at his feet, you know, the shiny boy, the great education, the sportsman, the athlete, the, you know, the person that was most likely to sort of carve a bright future. But unfortunately, the older I got, the more I realised that this art world that I'd grown up in, where alcohol was perfectly normalised. You know, I grew up with people guzzling flagons of wines at openings, artists arguing over, you know, bladders of cheap white, and the whole sort of essence of what it is to grow up in a bohemian family was what I experienced. And so for me, alcohol was basically like the lubricant to make things happen. You know, my father, who fortunately is able to drink but is not an alcoholic, you know, he would, I would ring him up at 11 in the morning and I'd hear, I'd say, Jesus, Dad, it's 11 o'clock in the morning. Surely you're not, you know, having a drink. He says, yes, I'm having my 11s. And I said, yes, exactly, it's only 11. He said, well, it's better to have one at 11 than 11 at 1. And he was capable of having one at 11, putting the cork back on and putting it back in the fridge. Now, for me, that's impossible. Mm-hmm. I could never do such a thing. Once it was open, that was, you know, it was history. But I think one of the things that really made me realise that, you know, what position I was in with this, whether you call it a disease or whatever, I know that a lot of my addiction was based on the fact that alcohol for me became medicine. It was a thing that basically coveted the pain and the trauma of growing up in a world where I was always a tiny little boy compared to somebody else. And I'd also suffered child abuse at a religious camp. And I didn't think those things really had much influence in regard to where my life was going. But the older I got, the more these things rose. And I understand how people suicide many years after experiencing traumas. So really, alcohol became a crutch for me to basically push down a lot of feelings. That the older I got, the more sensitive I became, and alcohol was the answer. But I really am in a situation now where, as Margaret Ollie, my dear friend, who was a woman who, as we all know, was a very important Australian artist, but she was a woman who died. I think one of the great lines of Margaret's was once I was. She had no fear of saying anything. She just told everything straight. And I remember once being at a drinks party, and I think I'd only been sober for about 6 months. And I said, how are you going, Margaret? She said, well, I haven't had an orgasm for 40 years or a drink in 47, and I don't know what I miss more. Thanks, Margaret. It's a bit much information, but thanks for sharing that. And I said, well, I'm now 6 months sober. She said, good. She said, but don't think that you've beaten alcohol. The reason you're in AA is because alcohol beat you.
That's right.
You will never beat alcohol. So these are the things that really stay in my mind and remind me of why I just simply can't drink. My last drunk, more pertinently speaking, was Christmas morning in 2011 when I woke up under the Christmas tree and there were wine bottles on the floor like I'd been playing spin the bottle with myself. And my little son was leaning over me in tears saying, Daddy, why did you have to drink? What's wrong with you? Why can't you? I really wanted you to help me open my presents. And I remember that moment as being the most devastating moment of my life, that I'd let down my little boy. The next day, I was on a flight to Palm Springs. I'd been to a rehab before, and unfortunately there was someone there who had told the press that I was there, and I didn't think I was that important or that interesting. But the Sunday paper said which son of Australian artist is in rehab at the moment dealing with his addiction, which is very cruel of the newspapers to divulge such things.
Yeah.
So I was determined to get sober, and I wanted to go somewhere where I was nobody. Mm. And there I was knocking on the doors of the Betty Ford Clinic in Palm Desert. And I was let in, and I remember being taken into a room, and there was a counsellor there, and he was this huge man who was an ex-footballer, gridiron player, who was apparently quite a big name. Not following that sport, I didn't know, but apparently he was a legend. And he looked at me and he said, and he had this face, you know, that looked like a brick wall. And he said, Tim, so here we are we, eh? So, we're here to try to stop you from drinking, are we? I said, well, I think that'd be a good start. He said, well, what's the worst thing that can happen to you if you go back and start drinking? I said, well, I could die. He said, no, boy. That's the best thing could happen, because according to your family, you're a damn pain in the ass. You know what? That's pretty cruel to hear, but he's damn right. That was exactly what I needed to hear. So I was going to stay for a month, and I ended up staying for a month, and I couldn't believe the company I was keeping. There was porn stars, movie stars, judges, doctors. I mean, if you want a lesson in egalitarianism, just go to an AA rehab, you know, or an addicts rehab. It's extraordinary. But of course, my first roommate, you know, was a guy who had been there for a couple of weeks longer than me, and we were sort of sitting up at night talking, and I was going on about my sob story, and you know, I'm so unfair, you know, so good at, you know, pour me another drink, self pity. And he said, Tim, I've been listening to you hammer on now. He was from the south, of course, and he said, if you think you've got problems, imagine my position. I said, well, what's your problem? He said, I'm the heir of Jim Beam. Oh, jeez, I really... You really are behind the eight ball, mate. But anyway, after a month, I realised how sick I really was, and that really I didn't have a drinking disorder. I had a thinking disorder. And that was something that couldn't be changed overnight. But sure enough, having been there for a month, I knew that there was still a long way for me to go before I was in any proper centred space to be able to return to normal society and not be able to be back into some idea or something for me to think that I didn't have anything wrong with me. And so I basically rang my family, and I was missing my little boy like nothing. Of course, I was full of shame and guilt. And I said to my darling wife at the time, I said, I think I need to stay here a bit longer. And she said, how long? And I said, well, 90 days. And she said, well, if you've got to do what you think's best for you. And so I stayed there for 90 days, and I did the program, and it was amazing. There was Bob Hope Street and Alice, you know, Fred Astaire Avenue, and, you know, it was an amazing place. I actually fell in love with Palm Springs and Palm Desert as such, and Diana Shore Avenue, and it was extraordinary. It's sort of like where Hollywood meets, despair. It was extraordinary. But what happened to me in that time was I realised something very important, which is something that really is the thing that's paved the rest of my life for me, is that I learnt that I couldn't think my way into a new way of living. I could only live my way into a new way of thinking. And that really and truly is true for all of us in anything we do. You know, we think that our mind is the most all-conquering thing. And I mean, I remember when I couldn't stop drinking, people would say, oh, don't you have any willpower? Of course not. You know, being an alcoholic is not about having enough willpower to stop. You don't have any willpower. I mean, nobody who drinks too much has any willpower. And most of us don't have willpower to do anything we don't want to do. That's just part of life. But anyway, I just want to finish on saying that it's a true honour to have been included in the book. And I must say the greatest gift to me was certainly finding that I found a group of people that I could share my time with in meetings from all walks of society, and no matter of the socio-dynamic or geographic whatever, we are all the same. And I'm so grateful for the gift I've been given, not just to be a sober man, but someone that can help others. And that's where I'm really ungrateful. Thank you.
Many thanks to our three speakers. Both of whom had terrific stories to tell, which quite gripped the room. I should mention that Tim, I did introduce you earlier, but I should mention he's the author of the very successful memoir out a couple of years, Son of the Brush, right?
That's right.
Ellen the Nun one, I think, and I've got a copy upstairs, so it's a very good book. And you'll see what it's like by listening to, or you'll know what it's like by listening to Tim tonight. So we'll go to questions discussion. All our speakers went over a little bit, but they had great stories to tell. We've got 15 minutes, so we all come back up here. The copies of My Last Drink for sale after the function, and I'm sure the speakers here would be happy to sign it. But let's, the three of you up here, let's have Di in the middle, Tim over here, Ross over there. So just start with a very quick response. Why does AA work? It gets no government money, and yet it seems to work, and people get up and tell their stories. I mean, do recovering alcoholics have to talk about themselves? I mean, why does it work? So let's start with Di, very briefly, Di. Talk to the end of the room.
It from my perspective, it works because we are all equal. Tim mentioned that. Because there's no judgment, irrespective of how you come into the rooms, what sort of state you're in, and because there's a lot of identification. People come into the rooms with a lot of shame, a lot of remorse, and very quickly that can be normalised in the room because other people have done the same sorts of things that they've done.
Tim, why does it work?
I think there's a thing called collective consciousness. And when you're in a room with people who basically all have surrendered as such, there's just something about one alcoholic talking to another, as they say in the big book, that, as Di was saying, you know, it takes away the idea that perhaps you're not the only one that is going through this, and that together we can build some kind of strength.
Ross?
Well, before we came into AA, most of us suffered an enormous criticism and personal shame. And I came into AA and I heard people talking about the very things that I thought nobody ever knew about me. So identification is very important. But the fact that the meetings start on time and finish on time, and within that structure, sober alcoholics talk about what we used to be like, what happened and what we're like now, that does something for alcoholics that all the money in this big city couldn't buy.
Okay, so
I just wanted to ask everyone about first drink. Because if you're not going to drink your first drink, what was it that made you drink the first drink? I mean, it must start with the first drink. And what makes it different for you three with the first drink from people who don't become alcoholics? So,
Start with Ross.
What's the first drink?
We'll go the opposite way, Ross.
Well, I had my first drink in the place I had my last drink, Maisie's Hotel near Melbourne High School. I'd just turned 14 and I'd been to the doctors, as I often did, and we had no alcohol in our home. And I'd heard a brandy lime and soda was an exotic drink. So I asked the bartender, who was a drag queen, could I have a brandy lime and soda? And he said, yes, darling, but take your school cap off. And in my case, if I hadn't have started drinking at 14, I would have suicided at 17 because I carried so many terrible feelings. I felt like a garbage tip as a child. I had a mother who would lie when telling the truth would do. But if I hadn't have got released, and that's a strange word for an atheist, but if I hadn't have got released from the need to drink alcohol and take other drugs At 25, I wouldn't have made 26.
Wow. Di?
I guess my first instinct is to say to you, because I wanted to belong somewhere. I was from an alcoholic family. That didn't make me an alcoholic, but I never felt comfortable in my own skin. And when I drank alcohol, I did, very simply.
Tim?
Yeah, well, both my grandfathers died from this disease, so obviously there's a disposition for this gene to sort of enter the family at different points. My parents, you know, I grew up in Spain and France and before the age of seven, and we lived in poor villages where my father was making tapestries, and in a place where we didn't have cordial, my parents would put a little bit of wine in the water to give it flavour. And if they had known where I'd end up, they probably wouldn't have done that. But that's where I had my first drink.
Shall we go to Andrew and we come up here?
Have any of you had a relapse, however brief?
So let's start with Di, and then we go to Tim, then we go to Ross.
My first exposure into Alcoholics Anonymous, I would say I wasn't really sober for the first 8 months that I was around. But I then had a bigger relapse over a four-day period, which is the one that propelled me in, so I've had that one. Thank God, no more.
I was introduced to Alcoholics Anonymous in Cleveland, Ohio, and I got deported late in 1969, because if you made more than two notifiable suicide attempts, they get very sick of paying the hospital bills. But I'd rung the Australian newspaper collect to tell them this famous writer was coming home. I'd written a note to the milkman. But they sent out a young reporter to write a big article about me. And in the Monday, there was a big article. And I bought a number of copies of this article. And I went back to Maisie's Hotel, where the Melbourne High School teachers used to drink. And I went back then to show what a great success I'd made in my life. But before they arrived, I got back on the piss. I finished up king-hitting one of these masters. I fled and I went to my friend Ken Gooding's place. I'd been to an AA meeting the night before and someone had given me a number. And Ken rang that number. And this bloke called Mick from Sandringham, who'd had a resentment against my father for years, because when my father was at the end of his career with Collingwood, Mick was starting with Carlton, and my father hit him over the head in the first minute of the game. He took me to an AA meeting, and there I met a man who did something remarkable. He never criticised me once. He took me and another bloke every night for the first 3 months. The German bloke blew his head off with a double barrel shotgun. I tried to kill myself yet again, but eventually I got sober. I stopped drinking, and I got sober up here in Sydney when I stopped taking all the barbiturates I was taking.
Jim, relapse?
Yes. I was invited to the Melbourne Cup. Yes, it's all impeccable timing. I was invited into a glamorous marquee, and somehow there was what looked like an orange juice ended up having something else in it. And the minute that hit me, of course, all my wiring changed. And away I was at, next thing you know, I'm in Paran in a nightclub with espresso martinis lined up. Mm. I flew back to Sydney and I felt such shame. I felt so dreadful. I first got sober in 2008, but I went back and I went and knocked on Margaret Olley's door. And she answered and I said, "Margaret, I've had a slip." She said, "Yeah, well, slippers, Tim, aren't things we put under the bed." Get back to meetings and get on with again and be honest with everybody. And that's what I did, and I'm still sober today.
There's a final question here.
Thanks. To the uninformed, it appears as though you just had your last drink and then came to AA, but you all demonstrate a fair degree of success. So what's it like going from your last drink back to society or back to, you know, back into reality and dealing with life and all its challenges that you obviously have?
Well, in my case, it wasn't going back into reality and back into society. I was out of it. So it was. I had to start from the very beginning. And a bit like Di, I went to a meeting every night for the first 5 years here in Sydney, and I didn't go to one too many. And it was only through going to the meetings And as I said, meeting my darling wife, Lyndall, on Guy Fawkes Day 1974, I'd never had a non-sexual relationship with a woman under 70. Well, I'll be 78 soon, but we were mates. And we got taken, and we went together to the Arncliffe meeting. And as I said, after listening to Lyndall talk about striving for adequacy, not for perfection, because before that, my motto was, if at first you don't succeed, stop. I was able to start writing, and I've authored or co-authored about 43 books. And this, you don't count this one as one of mine, but I've edited this one, co-edited this one.
So, Jim? The question is, you came out of it, you were successful. How do you explain that?
Look, I mean, there are a lot of people who still like to keep their addiction a secret and don't want to tell people they go to AA. But I'm perfectly open about it because I think if I can do it, you know, maybe there's someone else that thinks that they could do it too. But unfortunately, it's a very, you know, being an alcoholic was lonely, but also being a non-practicing alcoholic can be lonely too.
Indeed.
And I've lost a lot of friends because I don't drink anymore.
Mm.
And it says more about them than it says about me.
Absolutely.
So I'm happy with that.
Diane, do you want to make a comment?
I just thought it was hard getting sober, you know. Mm. I don't think it's an easy thing. I mean, we talk with a lot of experience here, but in the early days, very difficult. Mm. And that's why I did so many meetings.
And Gerard, I often say at meetings, say there's 20 of us at the meeting, I often say the reason they're around 220 is it's a very difficult business for an alcoholic man and woman to get sober and to stay sober. AA has the numbers, but it's very hard for alcoholics to stop drinking and to stay stopped.
I'm just going to ask you all, because we've got 2 minutes left, just a very brief point. I mean, there is some criticism of AA because there's a reference to God. Seems very unfair, because AA works. But what's the response to that? I mean, what does God mean in AA?
Well, I'm an atheist, and I think it's unlikely after being sober 52 years I'm going to change. But I'm not sober because of my own strength or cleverness. I'm only sober, as Tim said, because I surrendered. And Alcoholics Anonymous is a power greater than myself. A power greater than myself brought me into AA, and that was the power of alcohol and other drugs. So when I was new, they often used to say, there's room for us all, those that believe in God, those that don't believe in God, and those who think they are God.
You
two
want to add to that?
No, I think
that's a good way to finish. Thanks to Ross and Di and Tim for what was a very important but also very entertaining meeting, and we always finish on time, but some of us have got a meeting to go to any rate, so we better finish on time tonight. So as I said, the copies of My Last Drink are around. The three speakers will sign it. You may get someone else in the audience to sign it, or you may not, depending on whether they want to or not, but I think it's one of the most important things we've done tonight. But it was also amusing as well, which is what we like to do at the Sydney Institute. So thanks to our three speakers.